How does this tie in?
So we decided to just take a digression this week because I was just the topic had come up over of machlokesin in different in hashkafa, and how do we treat that? How do we handle that? You know, how do we view a machlokesin in hashkafa, and if it's something that you would, even if you disagree with it, what's necessary? What's the approach that you should take to combat it if need be? I mentioned that, you know, the Rambam and the Ramban have very big machlokesin, and at the end of Shaar Gemul, the Ramban kind of papers over the differences between him and the Rambam, right? And it led me to the famous letter of the Ramban to the French rabbis, where he staunchly defends the Rambam. And I just thought it would be interesting to go through. I never really went through it in detail. I was reading it over. I thought at least everybody would enjoy to hear it. So it's fascinating. So just the basic backdrop is that the basic backdrop is like this. He says, I'm using Chevelle's translation. So says that around 1191, okay, the Rambam finished the Morning of Vilchum. He says it's approximately 13 years before he died. Okay. Took about 9 years, he says over here, for the Mor Nevuchim to reach the Western countries, he's calling them. All right. Depends which way you're, right? The Western countries. All right. Anyway, so he says like this. And then they started becoming translated. Ibn Tibbon of Lunil did the translation, and that's Provence, France. And that translation was completed, he says, in the year of the Rambam's death. Okay, so that's what he says.
I know the Rambam.
He corresponded with the Rambam, but apparently on sections, but it wasn't completed, he says over here, in the year of his death. He could have seen it before he died, the same year. It didn't say the moment of his death.
Right. I guess he was with it till he died.
I guess so. So anyway, so but he says because of the difficulty in the terminology of Ibn Tibbon's translation, so they commissioned another translation by the renowned poet Yehuda ben Shlomo al-Kharizi. And that's the translation that the Ramban was basically working with. And a lot of things are attributed to bad translating on al-Kharizi's part. But anyway, that's not the issue here. So what happened was, when the rabbis of northern France got hold of this, of the Rambam, they were very upset. And Rav Shlomo from the mountain, not Avraham Minahar, but apparently they had
a group of people.
As one of the mountain men, he and his pupils put the Rambam in, put the Mor Nevuchim in Chirim. Now, it wasn't limited to the Mor Nevuchim, it was the Mor Nevuchim and the Sefer Hamada. Now, one of the pupils was Rabbeinu Yonah, who was a cousin of the Ramban, and cousin of the Ramban. Okay. So,
here's the people of the Shlomo Minahar.
Yeah, Shlomo ben Ahar had his two pupils, Rabbi Yonah ben Avraham, that was the Ramban's cousin, and Mechutin, and David ben Shaul. Okay, so Rabbi Shlomo and his pupils, they began to express the opinions that the two books constitute a threat to religion, and therefore were not to be studied. Okay, and eventually they put the a cherem on the study of the Mor Nevuchim and the Sefer Hamada. Okay. Now, one second. I'm sorry, they're not northern France. That's Montpellier. So they're Montpellier. That's more of the Provence, I think. A little confusing to me, exactly. But anyway, so then the action on the part of the rabbis of northern France, inflamed the communities of southern France, and in northern Spain, where many people advised the banning of Shlomo and his pupils by the communal authorities. So then it became cross Haramim. Okay? So, all right, maybe I got my regions of France mixed up. But anyway, you got the basic point. So the northern French rabbis, it seems, put the Rambam's works in Cheirim, Morin Vuchim and Sefer Mada. Then the southern French, that was Lunil, I guess, and northern Spain, put them in Cheirim. Okay, and then they came to the Ramban to try to mediate this problem. Okay.
He was recognized as the greatest among them.
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, he definitely was recognized as a tremendous Bala Masora, but I guess he was not in it, and he felt he could help. And there were two letters. One was to try to get Rabbi Shlomo out of the Cheirim, and then this is the one that's dealing with the Rambam. Okay.
Rabbi Shlomo wasn't good for the Rambam.
Yes.
The Ramban advocated also.
I believe so, yeah.
What did they not like about the Mora?
And that's what he's going to try to go through a little bit, too. They didn't like the philosophy. They didn't like the Greek philosophy elements of it. Well, he goes through some of the things that he says they didn't like. Okay? Now, the Ramban, you know, no one writes a polemic like the Ramban. I mean, just the combination of his poetics and his marshaling sources and arguments and his style, it's amazing. But for the sake of time, I'm going to cut down a little bit on his poetics. Okay. I mean, if you look through, everything is just filled with allusions. And it's a little bit hard to figure out what they all are about. I mean, he tries to help. But the bottom line is, he starts out like this. Basically starts out humbly, extremely humbly. It says, before I answer, I did err. Okay. That's the opening line. The letter sometimes is known as that, by that. You want me to lower the volume here? Okay, that's his opening line. Terem ena ani shogig. Before I start, I am already I do err. Pasuk from Tehillim. So he says, it means to say, as the Meiri says, it means I'm cognizant of my incompetence in relation to you, even before I begin speaking, and bring myself into a situation for which I am not qualified. So the whole tenor of the first few pages of the Ramban is how he is nichne completely to the Chachmei Tzarfas, and he recognizes their tremendous authority in Halacha and in Torah, and he is nothing compared to them, etc., etc. And he only comes to, I am as an ant, okay, there's not a word on my tongue, I am the despised of the people, a worm, I have not learned wisdom and knowledge, okay. So he becomes very. I am tired and dread. I am trembling and sweating. I am kneeling on my knees. I am bowing down upon my face. I am prostration, being the spreading out of hands and feet. Okay. So basically, he comes to them and says, "Look, he's not trying to bully them in any way. He recognizes their authority, and he is speaking to them. He says, "I'm coming as a student." And a Talmud who simply wants to understand what you're saying. Rabbis of France, we are your disciples and we drink your waters. Your words have reached us. Let us discuss them. We are not as disputants against them, but our sole intention conforms with the statement of the rabbis in the Yerushalmi. Reish Lakish debated with Rabbi Yochanan, not for the purpose of differing with him, but only to have the law clarified. Okay, so he says, look, I'm not coming to impose a position upon you. You are our leaders. You are recognized leaders, and he considers himself like a student. But he says even the student has to ask his Rebbe to teach him if he doesn't understand it. Okay, now he says in this manner, I'm on 370, and in accordance with the subject, I will make inquiry before your honor. I shall listen for your reasons. After these things and this loyalty, For I have seen your pure agreed upon advice and the signature of your hallowed congregation, all of whom are repairers of the breach and governors of the land, all of whom are prophets and are seers, all sprinklers and sons of sprinklers. Okay, come on. The entire country of France, its rabbis and princes, the cornerstone of her tribes, all of them have agreed to ban and to excommunicate every man who will lift up his hand to meditate upon the book of Mora Nevuchim, and in the Sefer Hamada, his horn shall be cut off. Okay? That is, all the horns of the wicked also cut off. That is to say, the aggressiveness of the wicked will be short-lived. Okay, so that was their ban. And regarding he who keeps them, there was one law for him, that he be put to death, okay, Esther, until they will be permanently concealed. This is essentially the formula of your words, condensed to a little from much, a spark from the great fire which shall not be quenched. Okay, so basically that was the edict, that no one is allowed to study the Mora Nevuchim and Sefer Hamada. Amazing, huh? The whole Sefer Hamada. Skip a little bit. He says, why did you, saints of the Most High, spread out the net of excommunication over most of the communities of Israel? So the first thing is, look, you're putting a huge group of Klal Yisrael into Cherem by saying this. Because apparently the Sefer Hamada was certainly very popular and widespread. And even the Mora Nevuchim apparently was studied by many people. He says, you have issued your decree not for the purpose of eliminating the thorns from the vineyard. Right? That's a mashal, that the Kadosh Baruch Hu sort of weeds out the vineyard. You know, why it kills the Rishayim from among Klal Yisrael. But rather to cut down the single bunches of the clusters of grape, thus destroying everything. So he says, look, he's trying to impress upon them. You have to take stock of what the effect of what you're doing is. You have to think about it. If you're in a position of promulgating some kind of a cherem, you have to consider the effect that you're creating. And he says, the effect is not an effect of simply weeding out or removing the thorns from the vineyard, which is a healthy kind of a weeding, but you're actually cutting down the clusters of grapes, the single bunches and the clusters of the grapes. You have yielded this land for prey and have made their wealth a desolation by wishing a curse on their life. Why? He says, you have not shown honor to the great rabbi who built a tower in the midst of the Talmud, a strong tower for the name of the Eternal and a sanctuary for the masses, the unlearned masses who go up into the breaches. He raised up the desolate house of our Talmud, which had been a perpetual desolation. So he says, you have to realize what he did over here. I mean, who are you going against? You have to also think about the person you're going against. You're going against the Rambam. What did the Rambam do? What did he achieve? He's somebody who gave a sanctuary to the masses. In what way? He says, first of all, he raised up the desolate house of our Talmud, which had been in the perpetual desolation. Very hard to go through Gemara for an average person and understand the halachas from it. So he says, the Rambam did a tremendous thing to the unlearned masses. Among all the captivity of his host in Sfarad, in the land of the West, and toward the East, and towards the, okay, to Eretz Yisrael, he was a savior and a defender. You have to realize that the Rambam was very active in preventing the Karayim from making inroads. Apparently that was a big... that was something he was very he was involved in. He says, Maimonides was a defender against the inroads of the Karoyim in the Jewish communities of Egypt and elsewhere. How many dispersed of faith has he gathered? In how many sanctuaries has he sprinkled the floors in order to repress the dust thereof? To how many hungry for wisdom is his bread given, his water sure? How many atheists and perverts who have put our Talmud to shame has he answered correctly? So he says, look, you have to recognize who the Rambam is and what his impact on Klal Yisrael was. He says he is somebody who has been makarev countless Jews who were, he's going to explain what they were taking, what their what they were involved in that he was rescuing them from. But he says the reality is that is the true stature of the Rambam, and you have not shown honor to that man. Okay, his whole life, his whole work was preserving and being Makariv, preserving the Torah, defending it against the Karayim, and being Makariv the masses. If you in France are in the bosom of faith, soundly implanted in the courtyards of tradition, full of sap and richness, will you not pay heed to those that dwell in the uttermost parts? So it was very nice for you in northern France, in the mountains over there, in the Alps, to say, well, we don't have any use for this. We're all maimin in Torah, and we don't have these problems of the Karayim, we don't have the problems of people becoming atheists, we don't have any of these problems. So he said, okay, look, if for your situation you don't think it's a value, but he says, will you not pay heed to those that dwell in the uttermost parts? In other words, you have to evaluate something like the Rambam, something like the philosophy and the Mor Nevuchim and the Mada, not in some pure idealized sense of what you feel is the where you're living. You're living in some high level place that doesn't have any need for the Mor Nevuchim. Fine, but you have to evaluate it in the setting that it's existing within, and in that setting it's essential, in that setting it's important. For them it's very necessary. You can't say, well, for us it's not necessary, so we should just ban it. Maimonides returned to the stronghold, the prisoners of hope, and those who are forced to follow their lusts. Now he says the lusts over here are the lusts of the mind, which prompt individuals to follow the paths of thought alien and contrary to our religion. I'm sure that's correct. He has satisfied with our faith. Okay, those who are forced to follow their lust, he is satisfied with our faith, and now they satiate their souls in our tradition, instead of filling their maw, stomach, with the vanities of the Greek philosophers, and feeding their bellies and engulfing ruin. Previously, so that was a time. So the Rambam was critical in helping people. It's the Mor Nevuchim, right? It's for the Nevuchim. So you can't say, well, we're not Nevuchim in northern France, so we should ban the Mor Nevuchim. That's very nice, you're not Nevuchim, but there are people who are Nevuchim, there are people who are in doubt, who are confused, and for them it's necessary. He says people at that time were being taken away because of the arguments of the Greeks. And the Rambam was the person who was able to bring the honor back to Torah. He says, previously in their mouth there was a rod of pride against us. Right? Previously, with stammering lips, they spoke against trusting souls and hoping spirits. They would shake the head, insultingly gesticulating against the Torah, saying, there is no reason for this, for the prohibition of sin. No purpose for the performance of commandments. They pondered not in the ways of our Torah, and they pleased themselves in the brood of aliens, meaning the aliens being the Greeks. Were it not that they now live by the words of the rabbi, and by his books, and satiate their souls with the substance of his wisdom, and prosper in the tents of the testimony, their steps had well nigh slipped. Right, that's a pasuk. That's a quote from Tillim. Right. So he says that you have to recognize what the Rambam did. Right. He very nice. You don't like Greek philosophy? Okay, fine. But the reality is, large segment of the Jewish population was exposed to this and were therefore led to deride Torah and say the Yevanim have the Chachma, and what do we have? So the Rambam was the one who was able to answer that claim and show the return, the idea, and the return Torah to its proper stature. It says, was it for you, majesties of the Torah, that Maimonides wearied himself? Right? No. He was as one who is compelled and forced to build a boundary to flee there from the pursuing Greek philosophers and to be far from Aristotle and Galen. So he says, you're acting like he wrote it for you. And he said, well, we don't need this. Let's get rid of this book. That's not the proper way to evaluate the situation. It wasn't for you.
Question.
Yeah.
Does the Ramban...
Is the Ramban saying that it's... is he saying that it's not true, but it helped? Or is he saying it's true? He's not arguing. See, that's the genius of the Ramban. Okay? He is able to construct multi-leveled arguments. And he's saying, look, the first thing you have to think about when you're putting a person in Cheirem is what, in fact, did he accomplish? And to put someone who accomplished a good in Cheirem is tantamount to negating that good or dismissing the benefit that he created. Now, whether you think, forget about whether the philosophy itself is good or not. Did the Rambam bring people who were leaving Judaism because of Greek philosophy back to Torah? Yes. Now, I don't think they're saying that people who were impacted by the Mora are not practicing Judaism. Right? Maybe they held it's not, he's borrowing from the foreign, whatever it is. But the first point is, look, he's not creating, I'm going to emphasize this, he builds up, you know, he's a brick by brick builder. So don't hang everything on each statement he makes, okay? He's building a picture. Let's finish the picture and then we'll come back to it in one second. So the first thing he says, he's definitely brought these people back from the brink, okay? And I think the point he's going to try to make is whether you agree with that methodology or not, you cannot say that the Rambam is, so to speak, starting a new movement. He's not like Karoyim and Baisusim Chasron. He's not starting a new movement. He's not breaking away from Torah. Okay? And he'll show you why. He says, have you heard their words? Have you gone astray by their proofs? So he says, first of all, let it not come unto you, our rabbis. Behold, and see if there is a pain like unto our pain. He says, but his main thing is like this. He's being very critical of them for sitting in judgment in their ivory towers, essentially. He says, he's done with the humble part of the letter, by the way. Okay, now he's warming up. He's warming up. By the end, he's going to Hashem them. but he's building up. He's saying, look, you're not in a position to judge. You're not exposed. Were you exposed to this to the challenges of the Greek philosophy that the community of the Rambam was addressing himself to us? You think he was writing this for you? Can you fully evaluate the impact and the harm that befell the community that he was dealing with? No. He says, have you heard their words? Have you gone astray by their proofs? Okay. Let it not come unto you, our rabbis. Behold, and see if there is a pain like unto our pain. We're suffering over here. And the Rambam is the one who saved us. Children have been exiled from their father's table. They defiled themselves with the king's foods and with the wine which they drank. They mingled themselves with the nations and they learned from their word, from their works. How much more because of our sins has the sword of apostasy left over in the captivity of Yerushalayim that it is in Sfarad. The rabbis of the Talmud have permitted those close to the governing powers, listen to this, to learn Greek wisdom. So, lest you think the Ramban, everything is a chachma on the Ramban. He says, and don't think the guys that are being involved, that are involved in the Greek philosophy, are sinners, and we should just write them off. No, that's not true. That's not true. The Chachamim allowed people to be involved in Greek philosophy, in the Greek wisdom. He says because they were close to the governing powers. So Chachamim allowed this. They let this exposure to the Greek wisdom occur. for certain practical reasons, which included these skills: to understand the art of medicine, to estimate measurements, to know all the forms of construction, and the rest of the Greek scholars' wisdoms and counsels, in order to sustain themselves in the royal courts and palaces. So there was a necessity of involving themselves, exposing themselves, steeping themselves in the Greek knowledge, Greek chachma. Okay. Now that creates this problem. So of course, that's a problem that they're exposed to. That's a legitimate concern that has to be addressed. You can't just say, ignore it. Ignore all the chachma that you learn. Yet although these sciences are permissible, Ramban says it's permissible, our rabbis of blessed memory cautioned us about them and commanded us concerning them. When the books of our wisdom were lost in the destruction of our homeland, and it became necessary to study these sciences from the books of the Greeks and the various peoples, hearts were attracted to apostasy. So, it sounds like he's saying there was a little bit of a development. First, they were allowed to be, because they were close to the government. But then he says, we lost our ability. Apparently, he held that the Jews had their own sciences, their own methodologies of practical skills that were equal to the Greek science. But we lost that in the destruction of the homeland, and then we had to learn these things. And then, once that happened, they were attracted to the apostasy. They began with glory and ended with disgrace. Maschil b'shevach u'msayim b'gnus. The rabbi has made his books as a shield against punishment, a buckler against the arrows of the bows of the children of Yovan. Okay. Writers that write iniquity. His works serve to raise up those who are drowning in their tumultuous pit out of the miry clay. Okay, something from Psalms. Okay. Philosophy is compared to the miry clay because neither offers a firm foothold to the person caught therein. That's the Yeshiva. To you, rabbis of France, it appears that the book, Mor Nevuchim, in its chapters and sections, that in its pursuits to bring near those who are far from the truth, he has deviated from the line. That's what you think. You think you're reading Mor Nevuchim, you say he went over the line. Okay, he was trying to help, but he went over the line. Demarcating religious propriety. That he has gone forth in the footsteps of the Greek philosophy and has knocked on the gates of wisdom. You find it difficult to accept that he pushed aside his enemies with stubble. I'm not sure what the meaning of that line is. I mean, that's an expression, to push off an argument with cash, like with nothing. With a vague or paltry reply, he dismissed the philosophers. Now, I guess they were saying that in the Mor Nevuchim, he didn't really... I guess he's trying to say that the way he made the book, the Mor Nevuchim, he gave the impression that the philosophers... He gave a lip service to dismissing the philosophers, but it seems like he really helped them. You know what I'm saying? Do you have any idea what I'm trying to say? In other words,
I don't know if that's how true is that, because
I'm not saying that's true. I'm just trying to understand his explanation of their criticism.
Push the cosh, like push the arguments out of the cosh.
He says you find it difficult to accept that he pushed aside his enemies with stubble. I'm just trying to unravel what he means.
I thought that meant that
when you push someone away with kash, that's an expression in the Gemara. It's like bekonesh el kash. It means it's futile. It's just like an exercise in futility. You know, vidocha bekonesh el kash. You want to push somebody away with a straw? It's just going to break when you do it. Right. I'm not really sure. I don't really know. In the Hebrew, it's not much easier to figure out what he's saying.
Yeah.
It's like what got Galileo nearly killed. That he wrote a book on the two possibilities of the heliocentric and the geocentric. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and he had like a little dialogue, and he got permission from the Pope to do it. But because he said, I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to give a dialogue. I'm not going to conclude any which way, you know. So he thought like that way he could avoid getting burnt at the stake like Bruno did. But the only problem is he named the guy who took the geocentric position Simplicio. And he made it very clear that he was stupid. So that's why he had to get, in the end, he had to plead not to get, you know.
He had to
recant, I mean, yeah. So I think it's that kind of thing, like you, maybe you used the philosophers and then you didn't, you know, you didn't really adequately dismiss them. But it's hard to figure out exactly what you're saying. Anyway, why, righteous judges, did you not put a curb on the mouth of your writing? Why did you not cast the bridle of your humility on the face of your words in order to teach yourself thus? Listen to this. Harlots paint one another. How much more then must scholars be heedful of one another's honor? So he says that's a Gemara and Shabbos. That Zonos, they help each other look beautiful. Even though they're competition, they help each other look beautiful. So he says, Talmidei Chachamim should be concerned for each other's honor. So the Rambam was someone who was indisputable. I mean, what he was. How could you say that, how could you not be concerned with his honor? Just common derech eretz. You have spoken haughtily. And he's saying the derech of the way they spoke was haughtily. Disgraceful words, unheard of, for which the eyes of our community shall sorely weep. You have let arrogancy come out of your mouth, words which seem to have been said to arouse jealousy and hatred. And now he's saying the way you spoke aroused hatred and jealousy. It is forbidden to hear them, certainly to utter them, and all the more to write them. Okay. Yeah. Now listen to this. Listen to this. Listen to this. It's hard to skip things. It's just everything's so interesting. He says, you have written and spoken about that saintly man. Yet in all the captivity of France and Spain, there has neither arisen any like him, and he that satisfies abundantly shall be satisfied also himself. What the heck? So he says, it's a mashal. The scholar who studies Torah in its widest sense, such as Maimonides did, has the reward of being entitled to teach it to others. All right? Who is a teacher like him? Who is proficient in all types of wisdom? And all of his compositions and books are only a kav, but well sifted. Kav v'naki. Kav v'naki. In that letter that I was reading from on Sunday, on the Maamar Tchias HaMesim, the Ram also makes that point. He says, you ask me, he says, the reason why people think I didn't believe in Tchias HaMesim is, right, is because I spent pages on Olam Haba and explaining how it's not physical. And then when it came to Tchias HaMesim, I wrote one word, one line, literally one line, right? So is it people took from that, he thinks, people took from that, that he was really padding the Olam Haba side and the non-physical. And he didn't really hold from Tchias HaMesim because of the physical thing. He didn't believe in the physical reward. So he just like popped, you know, one quick little line, like a Kona Shokash type of an argument, right? So he says, but you don't understand. He says, I try to conserve every word. He says, I have no interest in writing big books. I try to write in the briefest form possible. He says, Olam Haba is very hard to understand. It takes pages to explain it. Tchias HaMesim, it's just a mace. What's so hard to understand? Tchias HaMesim. So he says, you can't, I'm not writing more or less based on the importance. It's based on what is necessary to convey the idea. You know? Okay. Good? So he says, yeah. Maybe zealotry is better than better word than jealousy. Okay, so he says like this. He says, you have opened a mouth without measure and have multiplied words heard from afar. When you said of the Gaon, this is what they said about the Rambam, we have one greater than he, who, and it rhymed, who became a Sadducee. So he says in the footnote, Rabbi Yochanan the high priest, Yochanan Hyrcanus, served in the ministry of the high priesthood for 80 years, and in the end he became a Sadducee. During the year of the Second Temple, the Sadducees were a sect which denied the authority of the oral tradition, Sadducim. So they said about the Rambam,
he's like that.
Don't be so embarrassed. We had one like that also, who became a Sadducee.
Really? They really ready to throw him out.
Well,
Well, they said, I'm sorry, can you, what's the...
They said, we have, said, these said? Are the rabbis who put the Rav Mechirim.
Okay.
We have one greater than he, in our tradition, who became a tzaduki.
In other words, he could be really great, but...
In other words, he's going on the wrong path. He's going on something right. He, or at least, exposure to these ideas, although he may be from now, exposure to these ideas ultimately leads to that. Behold, in this your answer, you are not right. You have not spoken of God's servant, the thing that is right. Right, like by Moshe. And I will reprove you, right, criticize you, admonish you, and set the cause before your eyes. I shall not respect any man's person. Right, because it's like a chilul Hashem. I will make speed and I will hasten to answer on this matter. Neither will I give flattering titles unto any man. Okay, everything is a quote from something here. Okay, so he's like this. I shall be zealous for the Gaon and his fear. So he says, because we say the Yira, the Mora that you have to have for a Chacham is like the Mora of Shemayim. So he says, for a Rebbe, it's like Mora Shemayim. He says, why do you deter the rabbi from his work? he just, everything is just, you know, is a puzzle.
Wasn't the
Rambam
dead by this point?
The Rambam was, yeah.
Who are they deterring?
Right. Why do you condemn the mighty just? Have you not asked them that go by the way, who prolong the speech, who stream forth with metaphors, who take up the parable in recounting the great rabbi's praise, the high degree of his saintliness, the strength of his belief, the might of his humility? The greatness of his ancestry, the magnanimity of his purse, his wondrous deeds, his awe-inspiring words, his cleaving to the fear and love of his God, and his reverence for of our Talmud. In other words, it's Shivchei Harama.
What was the line there about the purse?
I guess he gave tzedakah.
Oh.
Right. Not that he had a designer purse. Right? Okay, so
was it that he's wealthy?
I said the deeds, the magnanimity of his purse. That's like
that's generous.
Generosity. No, he wasn't a guy who hoarded his money. He was, I guess he had money from his brother at one point, and I guess the king took care of him. I'm not sure. Anyway,
he had to go to work.
Yeah, in the end, he had to go to work. His brother died. So he says, in the end of his commentary on the Mishnah, the Rambam lists seven generations of his ancestors, all of whom were leading rabbis or judges in their respective generations. Okay. So he says, it's interesting. He says, it's interesting. You got to look at the guy. You got to look at his life. You have to look at his characteristics. You have to look at his yichus. You have to look at the way he behaved. What was his life? He was a tzaddik. He had the strength in his emunah. He had anivus. He was a big Baal Tzedakah, but in the end is the most important. He cleaved to the fear and love of God and the reverence of the Talmud. Yeah? He loves the words of the sages and embraces them. To me, that's the main thing that he's trying to get. They are the desire of his eyes, the yearning of his soul, and the crown of his head. In other words, he never deviated from Chazal. Okay? And he always expressed his full faith in the Mesorah and in the Chachamim, and that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to bring remove the questions that people had against Chachamim, and that's always his whole derech. He has by the three katim of Medrash, you know. These make fun of the Chachamim, and these misrepresent them. That was his tafkid. Have you seen his books? Have you scrutinized his writings? Have you heard that he rebels against prohibitions? Listen to this. Whether easier or stricter ones? Did he omit any rabbinical ordinance or decree? Or fail to make a fence around the Torah? I mean, look. Did he avert his eyes from Erevin and Yodayim? Right? Has he forgotten the sheaf in the granary, or that poultry and cheese may be eaten, one after the other, unrestrictedly? Has he not been more restrict on this than the law requires? Interesting. He says, Maimonides states, after eating meat, of beast or a fowl, one must wait 6 hours before he may eat dairy products. The Ramban thinks that's a chumrah already. That's a big chumrah. But what's interesting is like this. Again, he's trying to show you the Baal HaMor held you can eat chicken and milk, apikorn, right? That's the Gemara calls it, apikorn. I don't know. I'm not sure. I just know. I know the Baal HaMor held it. I guess so. It seems like he didn't hold from that.
It's not King Del Reza. It's only about the whole King Del Reza stuff.
No. That's just the chumrah of after. One after the other. One after the other.
You can eat chicken right after.
Milk after chicken.
Right after chicken.
I believe so.
Oh,
right. In other words, the Gemara is saying you wait between basar and chalav. Because that could be the Reza. But chicken and chalav are not. So of course you don't eat them together, because eating them together is cooking them together. Cooking them together is cooking them. Right,
so the
but the chumrah of waiting 6 hours between each one, he didn't hold from that. I think the Baal HaMor is you wash off your hands, you wash out your mouth, whatever it is. Anyway,
and the Ramban saying that here because he says it's even seen the Ram added in as a chumrah.
So the point he's trying to show you, what he's trying to show you is, this is I think is the key point, is he's trying to show you you cannot say about the Rambam that he is deviating from the Masorah. What kind of a new movement is he making? Has he forgotten? If a guy is coming along, he's going to be like what do you call it? Like who is that big Mashiach Sheker guy?
Shabtai
Tzvi, right? I mean, you're going to find halachic anomalies. You're going to find he's not studying Yadayim and Erevin exactly as much as he's going into other things. So the point that he's trying to make this. The Rambam, you can't say that about the Rambam. You can't say the Rambam was entering into Greek philosophy, was becoming some kind of a mystic, some kind of a starting a new movement and breaking away and tzaddukim. To the letter of the law, to every drabana and every gzera and everything, he's there. He's even more machma in certain things. So you can't, you have to look at who are you excommunicating? Who are you putting a ban on? Someone whose whole life is to protect and preserve Torah. It's obvious that his involvement in what you don't like is from his perspective a necessity. And you don't have an arrogance to speak about him that way. Would you not think to who you're talking about? It's not a katlakanya, as they say. Yeah. The point is, and this is exactly the point I'm trying to make. What difference does it make if he's a halachas? The point is, you have to, if you don't agree with a guy, that's fine. You might not agree with a guy, right? But to put a guy in chayrim is you're saying about him that he is off the derech and he's starting you'd have to be saying he is like instituting a new movement, a breakaway from traditional Torah. Now, you have to look at who you're talking about. You're talking about a guy whose whole life was halacha, the yad hachazaka, every detail of the most obscure halachic principle, right? He's not a person who has any desire other than to embrace and uphold the words of Chazal. That's his whole life. That's his whole, the majority of his accomplishment. And you're gonna now sit on the sidelines and in the safety of the French Alps and say, "What is this guy doing with this philosophy? He's an apikoros. He's going into how could you say such a bit? Who are you talking about? You know who you're talking about? You're talking about someone whose whole essence is his love for Torah and Chazal and Chachamim." And it's expressed in every detail of halacha. He's saying you have an arrogance. That's what he's saying. He's saying you should have bridled your arrogance. You should have thought about who you're talking about before you open your mouth so wide. He's saying they were not mesunim bedin, basically. They were not mesunim bedin. You didn't take into account all of the factors before you made such a rash judgment. How could you think that the Rambam is going to be a guy who is throwing off the whole yoke of Torah to run after Greek philosophy? Does that look like that makes sense? Okay. So he says like this. It is not befitting for you, our rabbis, who behave unseemly while facing the East, who defeated the Sadducees, that were trampling among the mighty men? Who defeated the Sadducees that were trampling among them? Who? Who gave the Baisusim to the despoilers? Is it not Rabbi Maimon, the rabbi of blessed memory? Because the Eternal was with him? So, you know, he was the guy. Who actually saved Torah? Him. Okay? You're looking from the you're looking facing the east, and you're making proclamations. Well, who was in the trenches, fighting with the Tzukum and the Baisusim? Who defeated them? It is he who has confounded the riders on the horses and removed their chieftains from the court of the monarch of Egypt. They were in dread out of fear of him. They trembled at his majesty. And many people, and many from among the peoples of the land became Jews. Right? Esther's always, it's always easy to pull things out of there, right? For the fear of the rabbi had fallen upon them. Okay, and his fear was strengthened overall. So in other words, so that's who he is. I now attest for myself in the presence of my rabbis, heaven and earth, that we have heard from those who declared the truth that in all the lands of the kingdom of Yemen, this, by the way, is something that, this is a an exclusive. Chevelle says that there's no other record of what I'm about to read to you other than this letter. Okay? So you got an a scoop over here.
This is the only record of what he's about to read.
Ready?
He's the only manuscript
who's in. No, not
this book.
Oh,
summary.
Letter.
That one book.
I've got it in my hand.
Source, that one source.
Okay, he says, listen, in all the lands of the kingdom of Yemen, okay, in many communities which are occupied with the study of Torah and the fulfillment of the commandments for their own sake, they mention the name of the rabbi in each Kaddish they recited, saying, may he established his kingdom in your lifetime and during your days and during the life of our rabbi Moses ben Maimon. You heard of that?
Yeah. Are you allowed to do that? That's
a good question. He didn't seem to criticize him.
Did I still say it like that?
Who enlightened them in the Torah and placed them in a corner of light.
Wait, does he says it in
past? I guess it was when he was alive. They mentioned the name. He says, yeah. To revoke the severe restriction upon them. Okay, what happened to them? Okay, anyway. So he says like this. From their shoulders he has lifted the burdensome yoke of the kingdom, and they begin to be diminished by reason of the burden of kings and princes. Okay, I'm not sure where that's going on. Now, he says like this. When these communities hear the words of the issued curse of the excommunication, yeah, how do you think they're going to feel? Right? So now the Rambam's moving into another phase. He's saying, the Rambam, because of what he has done, he has risen to a superhero level in the eyes of many, many Jews in all of these provinces around in the East. Right? In Eretz Yisrael, in the Middle East over there. So what is going to happen when you excommunicate him? Well, we know what happened. They got excommunicated. He says, will they not remove the yoke of fear and pervert the words of the Torah? Will they defend the name of Maimonides by speaking against the rabbis of France. And everyone will be helping his neighbor to strengthen the loins and fortify the power regarding the words of the great rabbi. To those studying his book, they will say, be of good courage. The lightning which will ensue from the fire of controversy as the appearance of a flash of lightning will be racing and returning to strengthen the hands of the advocates of such study. That was basically saying it's going to be the Torah will become like two Torahs and all Israel will be divided. Okay? Into two opposing groups. One faction will enter into judgment in the valley of Yehoshaphat and the other will come and shall rest in the rugged valleys. I guess in the Alps. One faction will abide by your decree and the other will not be troubled by the decree of your learning. Even regarding one's household, listen to this. His Canaanite servants, the rabbis have commanded, one is not to instill undue fear in them, lest they may feed him forbidden food. Now, not on purpose, he says, but it means if you get them scared and nervous, they're going to make mistakes. Even regarding the three things, this is the Ramban. Only Ramban can say something like this. obligatory upon the household. Before the arrival of Shabbos, the rabbis have required the head of the house to relate them in a gentle manner. Iravtem, isartem, right? Hitivas and eros. You don't bark orders. Do the Erev. You know, take my sir. You say, Iravtem, isartem, hitivas and eros. You have to say it nicely. You can't come betrunia, right? You can't come like an aggressive dictator. That's not going to cause people to comply. On the contrary, it's going to shake them up. And in this case, it's going to cause a rebellion. So he says, if when you're treating your kananim, your avodim, and your family members, you have to be gentle, this is an irrefutable inference from a minor to a major, to kal vachomer. How much more so when cautioning many people and instructing great communities, a mighty and populous people among whom there are many pious men and numerous sages whom all are obligated to honor, how much more was it necessary to come with supplication and to instruct in a gentle manner? Now he's hitting them on another line. He's saying, your whole derech was wrong. Your whole derech was wrong. Even if you had a legitimate claim, right? Even if you had a legitimate claim, right? Your whole derech is counterproductive. So he's giving them musa because they did it in an aggressive way. Going back to the kinnah and the sinnah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's stop here.